The biggest joy in my life really is building connection. Just the more we connect, the more joy we feel.
Welcome to The Regeneration Will Be Funded. I'm your host, Matthew Monahan, and in this series, we're having conversations about regenerative finance, technology, and our living planet. How can we build an economy that's in service to life? Brought to you by Ma Earth. You can find all of our conversations at maearth.com. Thanks for joining us. Kia ora and welcome. Today's conversation is with Kay Baxter, co-founder of Kawanga Institute. Kawanga stewards the largest collection of heritage seeds in Aotearoa, New Zealand. Kay is a master gardener and educator. She needs no introduction to many of us in New Zealand. What a privilege to sit alongside and have this discussion with her. Let's dive right in with Kay Baxter. Today we are here with my friend, one of my personal heroes, Kay Baxter, co-founder of Kawanga Institute. Thank you so much for coming down and doing this, Kay.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure.
So for those who aren't familiar, Kawanga Institute, what is that?
Kawanga was a name that was gifted to us for the work that we were doing. It's changed over the years, but it started off originally was an organisation specifically set up to help save our New Zealand heritage food plants. So it started off just with the seed saving, but as we've collected this enormous collection of fruit trees and seeds, we then realised that there was a bit more to it and we needed to learn how to grow them in regenerative ways. It's not a lot of point holding, you know, these seeds and this tang and growing it in an industrial system. So we needed to relearn how to grow things in regenerative ways, which has been a big journey over the years. And now it's also really importantly about sharing that with others and in various ways, education and training, and it's almost where the main focus is going at the moment. A lot of people coming to us asking for support and training and seed saving and regenerative gardening, forest gardening, regenerative living, all kinds of aspects of it. So it's quite a broad organism now, but it started off just saving seeds.
Yeah. And regeneration, this is a word that you've been using for many years. It must be interesting from your perspective to now see it, you know, so much more mainstream.
Yeah, it's been quite a journey. The same with the word, we went through that with organic and then sustainable and now regenerative, yeah. Yeah, for me, it's if we're not renewing our resource base, it's not regenerative. And it's the resource base is the earth and our ecosystems and like all of life.
Right. Do you think it's been greenwashed a bit now?
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't know that that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, because everyone's next step is different.
Yeah.
And we've all got to take a step. So wherever we're coming from, a step in that direction is a good thing.
Mm.
And so, yeah, it will get people all mean different things by it.
Mm-hmm. So seed saving, you know, for those who aren't familiar, at a high level, what is involved in that? And then let's get into why it's so important.
I kind of came into it. I'd never heard of it. Like I have no background and I'm a preschool teacher and, you know, I've got a degree in geography and sociology and I've got no background, and although I've always been a gardener. And I have an unbroken line of feeding the family from the garden, like a totally unbroken line on both sides of my family.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing that gave me the biggest, I actually began seed saving with the fruit trees because I went to live in Northland and I discovered that the fruit trees in the garden centres don't really even fruit well in Northland because they've been bred and selected for export in other climates and soils, even within New Zealand. So then I started collecting all the wild ones and that became a big thing and I started learning about what was actually going on and da-da-da. But the thing with the seeds was I began that, well, it hit me when I went to Mystery Creek, the Farmers Field Days, one year, and it was just after that Russian nuclear disaster, Chernobyl. And we had friends in Holland who had to bulldoze the topsoil off their farm if they wanted to stay there, and it was horrendous in some parts of Europe. And the man in the seed tent at Mystery Creek told me that the only seeds we could buy in New Zealand that were grown in New Zealand was pukekohe, longkeeper onions, and all the rest came from Holland. And I mean, I now know that wasn't actually completely accurate, but it served to galvanise me at the time. I was a mother of four young children when he told me that. And I just went home knowing, I had no idea what I was going to do or how it would happen, that I needed to start saving seeds so that I had food security for my kids. So it was a real naive beginning, not having any understanding of what that would mean and how that would totally change my life. So, and then there was one more thing that happened which kind of got me on the track. So when I went to live in Kaiwaka with Bob, I didn't know anyone there, and I wanted to connect with other women in the community. So I joined the local gardening club, and I was only in my early 30s then, and they told me that there's a long waiting list, which is funny now to think of it, a long waiting list, and I forgot about it. So they put my name down, and the week after I got back from that Mystery Creek talk with the man in the seed tent down there, they rang me up and said, oh, would you like to come to Garden Club next week? So I went to Garden Club, and the minute I walked in the door, and this woman came straight up to me and she said, oh, you're that lady that saves the fruit trees. You might like these bean seeds. And I realised then that if we're going to have seeds we can save, they're with the old gardeners. They're with all the old people who've always saved them, always grown them. And right at that point in time, it was in the 1980s, that was the last generation who gardened, and they had no one to pass their seeds to. So I started collecting them, and I got heaps of publicity and magazines and TV, and they flooded in, hundreds and hundreds of them. And so I had to learn in a hurry how to save them. I mean, Indigenous people obviously always saved their own, every village, every Indigenous group of people always saved their own seeds, but they had a really narrow range of seeds compared to what was coming into me. So I had to learn, I mean, some things cross wildly in the environment, and if you plant, you know, a whole lot of pumpkins from the same genus and species, they're all going to cross if you plant them close together. So I had to learn a lot, and essentially I had to learn how to take responsibility. I felt responsibility for trying to save those seeds in a way that kept them strong, because what's happened over the last 100 or so years, mainly since the Second World War, is that people haven't really known how to save them, and they haven't been saved in ways that have kept them strong, a lot of them. Some things are fine, but a lot of them aren't. For example, I was sent two lots of golden bantam corn seed years ago, and both of them were sent to me with a similar letter saying, we've had these in our family for generations and they're not really producing good corn anymore and we don't know what to do with them, so they're sending them to me, sent them to me. And so I knew that the reason why they wouldn't have been producing good cobs anymore is because corn is genetically extremely diverse and you've got to have a large population to maintain that diversity, like 200 to 500 is what you have to grow if you want to save corn seed. And they were now growing, and they'd gone from growing them in whānau gardens to an individual backyard, and they didn't have a big enough population. So I put the two together thinking, well, that's all I can do. I'm not going to be able to, there's nothing else I can do. They were both New Zealand heirloom golden bantam corn seed. So putting them together did exactly like that. It gave the genetic diversity to that seed line, which meant we now have a golden bantam seed line in New Zealand, which we didn't have before, that was worked well. So there's a whole lot of different tricks and things, but minimum numbers and isolation distances for a lot of seeds are critical. So you've got to have more than one garden. If you want to save, like, I mean, the way that we really work is at the moment is we've got three isolation gardens. And so that means we can grow three Brassica oleraceae. Well, that's like a broccoli, a cabbage, a cauliflower, or a kale, or Brussels sprouts, mainly that range. You can grow three of those in 1 year. And if you grow enough seed, you can keep that seed for 3 years if you look after it well. So you could grow nine. You could keep nine alive. And if you've got like 90 in the collection, what's going to happen to the rest. So it's been a really, really big challenge.
And so you have to grow a seed garden distinct from what you're producing for food.
No, not necessarily. There are some things you can save from the seed garden really easily, like tomatoes, peppers, beans, peas. I've just written a booklet, the Revival booklet. It's called the Revival Garden Booklet, which shows you how to grow all your food for the family and how to grow the seeds. And it turns out that you need to have about a 40 or 50 square metre garden separate to the food garden. It can be next to it, but because there are lots of complications, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so some things can be saved in the garden and some things can't, yeah.
Got it. And I think some people, when they hear seed saving, they think about, you know, storing the seeds, you know, in a fridge or on a shelf somewhere, and maybe not fully appreciating that these are living beings that have to be cycled generation to generation. Can you share more about that?
Yeah, that's, I think things that the idea about seed saving is starting to change. I think people are a lot more conscious now than they were when I started out doing this. There were quite a few seed-saving organisations all around, even all around New Zealand and all around the world, and it was kind of about keeping them in like a seed bank. But the seed bank's not a lot of use, really. It's like the crazy thing in the Arctic. Like, what use is that going to be to New Zealand if, you know, we have some kind of international emergency and we need seeds? We're never going to get them out of that seed vault in the Arctic. They have to be in our gardens. And seeds are not, they don't stay the same. There's a lot of misunderstandings about that, I think. Mm. Seeds are, in the natural world, they're in a constant process of co-evolution with the earth and the universe and us. Mm. And we're in a constant state of, it's like that dance of life that we were talking about yesterday. Everything is behaving in relationship to everything around it. And so when we plant a seed, we are planting, you know, it's being planted with our energy. Depends how you plant it, of course, but there are lots of ways of planting a seed really intentionally, and it's going to grow in relationship to its connection with us and the earth and the sky, and it builds into it the changes that are happening in the ecosystem around it, and then that's something that we eat, and it changes us and it helps us stay in relationship to our environment, just in the same way the beehive works. And so every year you choose seeds from the healthiest plants or the ones you like the best for whatever reason, and it slightly changes them.
Mm.
You won't see that change maybe for several years or even longer.
Mm-hmm.
But it's never going to be exactly the same as it was the year before.
Mm-hmm.
And so keeping it in a seed bank is kind of, it might keep it alive for a while if there's no one growing it out. It might do that for sure. But really the only way to keep it alive, actually, what's the point of having a seed in a seed bank anyway? Like, if they don't become, they'll never be saved and they'll never be kept alive unless we are dependent on them for our food, just as they are dependent on us to grow them. Like, it's not like an intellectual pursuit. It's not like an intellectual hobby, which it kind of was for a few years, I think.
Mm.
But maybe that saved them, you know. But now it's time. We need them for our health. I don't think there's a great understanding why it's not really widely understood how important they are for our health. And we're not eating our food from those seeds. So these tonga that we have need to become the seeds that our food is grown from. And we can do that right now on a home gardener scale, but it's not happening on a larger scale, and it needs to happen on a larger scale.
Yeah. So why are these seeds so important for our health?
There's two aspects to that, I think. One of them is I've got no science background at all, right? So I listen and I learn, but because I haven't got a strong science background, I usually put things into quite simplistic ways of understanding and expressing it, which I think is quite helpful for a lot of people, because when you have the science background, you've got the science language, and it's often difficult for people to understand. So one of the things that helped me understand why these seeds are so important is gaining a bit of a basic understanding of what epigenetics is all about. And my understanding now is that that double helix spiral that I see in my mind's eye when we start talking about genetics isn't what we used to think it was. So we used to think that was our, you know, the DNA that was the DNA. But now we know our DNA is only a tiny part of that double helix spiral. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole lot more that originally, and it's not that long ago, maybe 30 years ago, scientists didn't know what the function of the rest of that was. And they called it the junk DNA, mm-hmm. which is a bit funny now, really. Mm-hmm. And we've learned over the last 30 years that part of our body, the rest of that double helix spiral, is the part of our body that communicates with the environment that we live in. And it's not just our food, it's the air we breathe and the thoughts we have and the friends we have and the work we do and the stress in our lives and everything. But food is important. And so we also know that the only part of our food that actually communicates with the junk DNA, which then places tags in our DNA, which determines how our body expresses, the only three things that we know of to this point that in our food that is actually what communicates with our junk DNA is the minerals and the vitamins and the fatty acids, traditional fats and oils. Mm-hmm. The rest of it, we don't understand. Well, we have not seen a connection yet between the other things and our junk DNA. So we know that we need high levels of minerals, vitamins, and fatty acids. And they need to be in a form that our body, our DNA, recognises. So if we are eating food from the supermarket that has been homogenised or had the fat taken out, or been emulsified or had extenders, or it's been grown with genetically engineered seed or even hybrid seeds, our body is not as able, the junk DNA is not as able to recognize the minerals and the vitamins and the fatty acids because they've been changed. Mm-hmm. And so we've got neural pathways and we've got like the way that our body operates is that we recognize the things we've co-evolved with mm-hmm. that we need. Mm-hmm. And we have never co-evolved with processed food and neither have we co-evolved with hybrid seeds. And with hybrid seeds and worse CMS seeds and worse genetic, well, CMS seeds are genetically engineered seeds.
Can you offer a couple of little definitions of hybrid seeds and CMS as you continue?
Well, probably the hybrid seeds is a really important one because a lot of people seem to think that, a lot of people believe that, I mean, a heritage seed is an open pollinated seed and it has begun as a hybrid seed just out in the natural world. I mean, things cross. Mm-hmm. But it still contains the full range of genetics. Like it's genetically diverse. It's able to cope with climate change and, you know, changing weather patterns, all kinds of changes the seeds can cope with because they've co-evolved in that ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And they've also been stabilized, like something that crosses it in the wild or even that you've crossed in the natural world, then we stabilize them by growing them out year after year and so that when you plant that seed, you know what you're going to get. Mm-hmm. Well, in a laboratory where we are creating our F1 hybrids, we're largely creating them by narrowing the genetic base of that seed. Mm-hmm. If we want a broccoli with a big head, well, we narrow the genetics, we narrow the range of genes that's in there so that we're just focusing on the big head. Mm-hmm. So it's a completely different thing to having a widely diverse hybrid seed that is evolved, co-evolved in out in the wild or in a garden or, mm-hmm. you know, where there's insects and everything, mm-hmm. to one in a laboratory where it's just focused on one thing. And usually it's about production or size or something like that, mm-hmm. and we know that when you breed something for production, you lose the nutrition.
Right.
Well, we've known that for a long time. So
the industrial food system is optimizing for shelf life, aesthetics, size, and output and throughput, but it's not optimizing for nutritional content,
no.
biodiversity,
yeah,
or complexity, resilience.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So that's the main problem with the modern hybrids. But there's another problem with them, which I would never hear talked about. And that is that in these hybrid seeds, I'm a bit limited here because I'm not a scientist, but they have enzyme blockers in their roots. They develop enzyme blockers in their roots for some reason when they breed like that, which means the roots of those plants are unable to fully communicate with the life in the soil and they do not pick up key minerals that we need, that those plants need to be nutrient dense and that we need to be healthy. Mm-hmm. For example, manganese. And a lot of people call manganese the element of life. It's at the heart of every single seed, mm-hmm. our seed, animal seed, vegetable seed. And it, we're breeding plants with enzyme blockers to prevent them picking up that. So there's no seeds in the cucumbers and no seeds in the watermelons. And so there's a lot of other stuff going on that we aren't really told about, where those plants are unable to fully communicate with the life in the soil, which means they then won't be able to fully communicate. Mm-hmm. I mean, that the strength of the electrical current flowing in the plants, which is created by how the soil health and the ability of that plant to communicate with the soil, the life in the soil, is what enables it to pull in a lot of what it needs from the universe. So mm-hmm. All of that is limited by having hybrid seeds. So mm-hmm. I think, CMS seeds are, in America, there's a loophole in the regulations where if it's a CMS seed, you're allowed to organic growers can use it.
What does CMS mean?
It stands for cytoplasmic male sterility, and it's a horrendous process of irradiating a sunflower seed and a sunflower cell and a frog cell or something, and take half of that one away and the other half of that one away, and you join them together and end up with something. I mean, it's a crazy story. End up with something that can't survive in the wild and can't reproduce itself. And a lot of the in New Zealand, organic growers can use those seeds, which they're calling hybrids. Mm. They're getting away with calling them F1 hybrids, but they're not. Mm. They're actually genetically engineered, but they're not even calling them that. It's all a bit of a loophole thing. Mm. So biodynamic growers aren't allowed to use those seeds, but in New Zealand, organic growers are. So it's highly likely that organic broccoli seed is grown from genetically engineered seed, but no one knows that it is, because that's how brassicas are being bred these days. Brassica seed is mostly CMS seed.
Got it.
So going back to the thread before, is the more the seeds are manipulated and they're not a natural seed that has, you know, is co-evolved in a natural environment, the less they can communicate with the life in the soil via the microbes, and the less strength they'll have, the less they can pull in for the universe, the less our junk DNA will recognize them as food. And I think it's fairly clear now that, I mean, there's any amount of science out there now which shows us that our lives are getting shorter again. Our health is a lot worse. And I believe that having open pollinated heritage seeds grown in living alive soil to create hybrid seed is a part of what is essential. It's how we've co-evolved. And if we need to rebuild those relationships and those connections with the soil, the ecosystem, our food, and it begins with the seed. Because the seeds are actually, I kind of see the seeds as a thing that transmutes the energy of the earth and the sky into some kind of thing that our bodies are able to utilize that nourishes us. It's like it's a part of us, and we are built from those seeds, and the seeds are built from the earth and the energies of the universe, and it all becomes us. And so I think that's why, if we've co-evolved in this land, we're going to be different to the people that might have co-evolved in Africa or Asia or somewhere else, because that's what makes us different, is our co-evolution with a different ecosystem, which includes the seeds in the loop.
Right.
So if we're going to go to the supermarket and eat food that's come from China, our bodies are going to actually co-evolve in relationship to that. We're going to be changing and co-evolving to become somebody who's reacting to the environment in China. And that's bizarre. Like, that's crazy stuff. But that's what we're doing. Mm-hmm. So I feel like part of this revolution is growing our own seeds, or buying seeds from people who are growing seeds from your own local area that are open pollinated seeds. Mm. I mean, it's not so long ago that I actually think it's still in some parts of Europe still exists, the understanding that if you want to plant a fruit tree, you plant a fruit tree that's come from this bioregion. Mm-hmm. It's adapted. I mean, that's why the fruit trees in the garden centres wouldn't work for us in Northland, because they didn't come from that. They weren't bred, or they weren't co-evolved in that bioregion. Because mm-hmm. in New Zealand now, we're totally focused on export dollars so we can sustain the standard of life that we have. And so we're breeding, the government dollars are all going into breeding what makes money in the Northern Hemisphere, somewhere else. And so it's not the plants, it's not being bred as food to nourish us. Mm-hmm. We just get the second grade stuff in the supermarket.
Right.
So, yeah.
Can you say more just about what you mean by this term, open pollinator?
Well, if something's open pollinated, it's open for the bees, all the insects. It's open for pollen to come in from other plants. It's kind of a random thing. It's not something that we're controlling. It's something that's, it just means that it's a co-evolution that's happening in our natural world in a very natural way. And there's lots of crossing happening, and it maintains diversity and it maintains the strength and resilience in the seeds. Mm-hmm. It's just not something we're controlling really mainly. Mm-hmm. It's just something that, I mean, that's how it's always been. The things are pollinated by the insects and the wind, and it happens in a random way. Mm-hmm. It's not totally random because bees only fly a certain distance and the wind only flies a certain, you know, this depends, but it happens the way it's always happened, and it's kind of quite random. Mm. And it maintains genetic diversity, and it maintains the resilience in the seeds in that process. And we start to control it. It's like the same as in a beehive. I use that analogy a lot because in a beehive, the bees have the most amazing ability to go out into their environment and select they can tell the bricks. They only collect nectar and pollen from plants where the bricks have over 7. Mm. They know that it's not good for them under that.
And bricks, what is bricks?
Bricks is the nutrient density. It's how much nutrient density, how much health value is in the nectar or the pollen. And they can tell. And like animals can tell which are the best plants to eat. Well, the bees go out, collect the best pollen and the best nectar to make the strongest, for the queen, to feed the queen, to lay the best eggs, to make the next generation, the eggs and the grubs, feed the grubs. And so they're constantly co-evolving with what's happening in their environment. It's like, it's exactly the same with the seeds in us. And we as industrial beekeepers go along and kill the queens in the hives every year and replace them with another queen that's going to make us more money. Mm-hmm. And so we've stopped the ability of the bees to co-evolve and maintain the health of the hive. Mm. We're doing the same things with ourselves. So I don't think it's easy to like look at the bees. It's not so easy to look at what we're doing, because how we eat is a challenging thing to talk about.
Right. Okay. So within New Zealand, there's knocks on the door and conversations happening that we're about to reopen the doors to genetic modification of our seeds. For those who aren't familiar, we've been GMO free as a country. Can you comment on what you're seeing in this landscape and help us understand what's going on?
Oh, I'm almost too scared to even think about it. Last time that came up was in 2000 when we had the Royal Commission on Genetic Engineering, and that inspired us to walk from Te Ringa Wairua down to Parliament. We walked for 10 weeks and talked the whole way and stayed on marae the whole way and walked with a lot of people heard a lot of stories. Essentially, if we bring genetically engineered seeds into New Zealand, I mean, they have been here already, but they had not widespread, and we've been really careful how we've kept our seeds separate to that. It's not an easy thing to do, because if someone plants a field of genetically engineered corn, you could end up with Roundup. If it's genetically to be resistant to Roundup, the Roundup ends up in the soil, translocates into the soil, lives on in the soil, goes into the roots of the next crop that goes there, even if it's not genetically engineered, and the pollen flies around, and it takes that DNA everywhere. Mm. So you can't isolate yourself from it. So if it's here, it's here. You can never really get rid of it. And I don't know a way that you can get rid of it. So it's really scary. And I've kind of got to the point, I think as you get older, the way you view things changes a bit. And I think we have to have I mean, we need to stand up against that. But for me right now, I think holding the trust and the faith, I mean, there is a lot of magic in the universe. There's a lot of amazing things that can happen. And I don't think, like when I was young, I was involved in all the political stuff and demonstrations, and I don't think I would do that again. Although I think if they tried to put a nuclear, you know, maybe genetic engineering's the same thing. I'd lie down in front of a machine to stop something happening. I think as you get older, you get more radical again. But and maybe there will be people that will do that to try and stop it coming in. But I think there's another field we can work in, which is more energetic. And I feel like it's a much more peaceful way to do it, and it doesn't create so much anger and so much aggression. And I do believe there are other ways things can happen. So at the moment, I think creating an environment that is full of life, like when you start planting and creating forest gardens and like the incredible insect populations and micro populations and bird populations, and you're building soil more like the terra preta soils in South America where they can grow themselves in the end. Just building life, just focus on building life and faith, sending out lots of good energy to all the other light workers, and just kind of building an environment or an ecosystem. I mean, we're not actually building it. We're kind of just taking steps that allows nature to come back in and really like do what it really wants to be doing.
Yeah.
We've been stopping it. That takes a lot of energy if you unblock the things that you've sort of been holding in there, then life comes back really fast. So I don't know what the answer is, but I believe for me now it's more in that area. It's more energetic, spiritual kind of a thing that will create the solutions. It has to be a peaceful solution. I kind of can't imagine myself in some of the demonstrations I was in when I was young. It created a lot of aggro and a lot of anger. So I'm not so sure about that, but maybe there is a role for it. I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't really feel like that's working anymore.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think about my own journey and like, you know, there's certain moments that you look back on and you don't even necessarily realize it at the time, but they really change your trajectory in some profound ways. And moments of connection with Earth, you know, have really guided my life in different ways. And one was down in Abel Tasman and just experiencing something that I'd never experienced, you know, in that forest and in that environment.
It doesn't come in through your head, does it?
No. And one was in the wildlands of Alaska and being with the glaciers. And there was like a transmission of energy. And one was in your garden. And I mentioned it yesterday to the group that we're with that. And it's the only example that I can point to where it wasn't an old growth, untouched wild landscape or untouched. I remember when I was at Kawanga, and I mean, you have so many gardens, but then there was also Kay's garden. And this was several years ago. And there was something about when I walked through the pathway of your garden and then I stopped and I was just surrounded by all of these plants and insects and bees and birds. And it was just unlike any garden I've ever been in. You know, I mean, it's not talking some manicured botanical garden or some, you know, veg market garden. Or I mean, there was some sort of complexity and energetic buzzing that was happening around me. And I just remember having this sense of like, this is possible. Like,
yeah, quite easily, actually.
Like, I've still never seen anything like it and felt anything like it, but I was just like, wow, this is possible. And if this is possible, my entire frame of what's possible kind of shifts and widens a bit.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, I just bring that up also in relationship to that question of like, can we make the shift from the energetic realms?
Have you heard the phrase quorum sensing that they're using? Yeah. So yeah. I feel like that's what's happening when you get enough biodiversity, and it's about diversity and connection. Mm. And once you get enough things in there, there's exponential life. And it's just a matter of like keeping pulling in the biodiversity and in terms of the microbes and the plants, and that pulls in the insects and the birds, and you get exponential result. Yeah, I'm getting my head around that phrase, quorum sensing. But in the beginning, I thought, oh my God, not another word that no one knows what it means. But it does have a meaning that's hard to describe in another way. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think that's what it is. It's like walking into the native bush and you just feel it immediately. And the native bush is always hugely diverse. I mean, it doesn't matter what forest you go into in the world, it's diverse. Mm-hmm. And that in itself creates such a high level of vibration that you feel it. Mm-hmm. And you don't ever feel that in an industrial agriculture system or food production or yeah. backyard with mowing lawns everywhere, and you just don't feel it in those environments. So there's got to be a certain amount of diversity and integration is what the two words that I think they're the most two important words in the permaculture that I got out of the permaculture movement. Mm. Diversity and integration, and it comes down, that's how nature operates. Mm. And yeah, there's a buzz. It's just a buzz, and you feel it without even understanding it. You feel it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've also felt it when eating your delicious food, your kai, you know, and I mean, you're just obviously a master at these things, but, you know, eating food on your land that you cook is just like, if anyone gets that experience, like it is very special. Okay. Yeah, enough compliments. Amazing. I have to ask you and humor me or sadly, let's go to some of the challenges that we currently face, because I mean, you have been pushing this ball up a mountain for decades. You've devoted your life. You are, you know, stewarding, running the largest heirloom collection of seeds in the country, one of the only countries that's still GMO free. You're, you know, not in your early 30s anymore. You're operating it as a nonprofit against all odds in a system that doesn't appreciate so many of the layers of the stack here. And I mean, I think those of us in the movement, if you will, you know, see you and see you as a hero and really appreciate the work. But that doesn't change the fact that there's some real challenges ahead.
There sure are. Right now we have the challenge right now for us is that I was told years ago by other people who've been involved in the same kind of work in America mainly, that the only way you can save the seeds is by, and like if we have a national collection of seeds in this land, the people of this land have to save them. And I guess in the beginning we thought, well, I mean, we've got a very high membership. We've got about 2,000 members, like paid up members, which is a higher percentage of the population than any other country in the world that I can figure out, a lot higher than America and other countries that have strong seed-saving organisations. But it's just not enough. Like we grow seeds and we sell them, but our main purpose is to save them. And you can't earn enough money from selling them. So it's been like we've just, over the last 30 to 40 years, we've just given everything, and we're at a point now where I can't keep working 80 hours a week and doing jobs with six hats on. And I actually can't pass it on because we don't earn enough money to pay someone to do the work. So we're at a really critical point, and I don't see any option other than to find a group of people in New Zealand who feel strongly enough about it to support us in some way. I mean, we've got a lot of amazing, apart from just the seeds, we've got some really strong, a lot of intellectual property that we've built up, which is really valuable. And we have a lot of people coming to us asking for support, and we can hardly support ourselves, let alone support other people, which we always try and do. So it's kind of time for Kāinga to change shape. And there's a few different ways that we really need support. We need financial support just to save the seed collection. But we also, I mean, I see that right now is the point at which these seeds which we have saved and which, I mean, those seeds are our whakapapa, they're us, you know, like, are we really going to be the generation to drop the ball of these things that we know that we need for the future? So So we need people to help us with that. But we also, because I'm managing Kōanga and I don't have the skills required to take this thing to another level. I just don't. And it all, everything comes back on me. So we actually need support from people with those kind of skills, like mentoring, business management. Like, we need someone to help us. There's a lot of funding out there, but we don't even know how to access it or have the skills to get the things together to, like, do the right thing to access it. So we need support in that direction as well as to save the seeds. And without being able to save the seeds in a way that honours the people who do the work, which it currently doesn't. I mean, some of us don't get paid and the rest of us don't get paid well enough. It's no longer good enough, really. It just wears you down and wears the organisation down, and it's time for us to, like, go get out there. So then the whole process of taking our seeds to become the seeds our food is grown from. I mean, there's a lot of amazing people out there now who can support with that, people like Jody and Jules, who I'm keen to work with there. But
Jody Roebuck and Jules Matthews.
But that's going to require investment as well. So, but I feel like we've built a lot of trust and a lot of networks and a lot of intellectual property. And, I mean, just the journey of learning how to grow our food, our vegetables and our fruit, and our animals, but mainly the vegetables and fruit we're talking about, in ways that regenerate the soil, the health of the plants, and the whole ecology and our bodies is really important information in the world out there right now. And we've done it in a way without using industrial fertilizer. So that's a real important information. And so those kind of things, we've got to find a way to take to the wider. We kind of have, it kind of seems crazy, because I've come from being an old hippie, really, but this needs to become mainstream. Like, I kind of see that, you know, those of us that have been the old hippies we've had amazing ethics and values and we've held on to them, but we haven't been very effective in some ways. And then there's all the ones that are super effective in modern, you know, in this modern industrial world, but lacking in some ethics and values. And we need to bring those two together. And so scary as it might be for me, the work that we've done and the seeds and the intellectual property we hold needs to become used in a very effective way now to, like, become accessible to a lot more people, I think.
Yeah. Do you have any visions of how it could fit within a broader global network of seed saving, or is that maybe the wrong approach because we really need to make sure that this is – you know, for and by Aotearoa. And yeah, because I'm aware that there are some global efforts around seed saving and people who may have a more open mind about it in terms of the funding landscape. But it's also like we need local. So how do you think about
this? I think there's two ways of looking at it. One of them is that I had someone in Bridget Elworthy. Have you connected up with her? I had her in my office the other day and I was explaining to her that she's living in, France at the moment, but was in London. In New Zealand, we hold the English Heritage Seed Collection. They haven't got them anymore. They've 20 years ago, I had a friend went over there and did a lot of research at what seeds they still had over there, and they had 90 heritage seed lines left in England that they could find. We've got hundreds of them and they've largely come from, a lot of them have come from there. They've come from all around the world, but a lot of them are from there. I think we hold a lot of seeds here that have been lost where they came from. So that's a connection that will need to be made at some point. Like they'll need to go back. I think we've, not only have we got a larger percentage of our population, like as members of Kōanga, but I think we've got our seeds have all come from somewhere else, let's face it. We're not eating food grown from the native bush anymore, largely. So they've all come with us from somewhere else. And we're the generation, we're the people on the planet right now that have to create a whole new food ecosystem. And we've got to choose the best seeds we can. And I think we have seeds that are going to need to go home. So that's one thing. America was kind of in the forefront of this whole movement. with the Seed Savers Exchange, which now there's, and well, actually, there were lots of other little ones when I first started out. And that's kind of morphing and changing over there now. But a lot of the seed saving organisations, which were people of my age, have all collapsed as the people have died or retired. So there's got to be a whole new way that involves younger people, obviously. I think that we've got to a point where we're realising that the only way you're really going to save seeds is people saving them in their own gardens. So that's very local. Mm. And it's also the best thing. But it has to be done on different scales, and it has to be done on scales that can supply seeds to the growers. I'm really only thinking about the small scale, like regenerative production people, really, who are springing up everywhere. Mm. I mean, we've had lots of phone calls from Australia, people wanting our seed, especially the people at Mexican restaurants that want the. We've got an amazing corn collection that's all not contaminated, probably maybe one of the best ones in the world, that all the colours of corn that are so I don't know. I'm not sure. I can't see that seed is a very good thing to be shipping around the world, because it's going to different currently right now, if you buy a carrot seed, it's actually probably been grown in New Zealand, because the world's carrot seed has been grown in New Zealand. Mm-hmm. But it's the same seed everyone's planting everywhere in the world. And I don't think we need to go back to that. We need to or even stay there. I think we've got to go to having bioregional seed.
Mm.
Yeah.
So it's kind of hard to see, apart from the fact that we do have a very international collection here. I mean, I've got things in the collection now which I haven't been able to find in overseas. I mean, I see all the overseas beautiful seed catalogues and things, and some of them you just never see.
So let me ask, what kind of cost realistically would be involved in saving X number of heirloom seed lines? Like, help us get like a better understanding. Is this many millions of dollars? Is it hundreds of millions of dollars? Is it tens of thousands of dollars? Like, what is involved? And how do we practically do it?
Well, there's obviously different levels of it. I think just to save, it costs us about $300,000 a year to employ a garden crew and keep a garden crew working. And that's like more than we can ever recoup from selling the seed. So $300,000 a year doesn't pay for the land and the infrastructure, but it pays for maintaining a garden crew. And so I would say like $500,000 would create amazing infrastructure, save a lot of isolation gardens so that you could do a really good job of saving the seed and pay the people in an honourable way to do the work. Mm-hmm.
$500,000 a year.
No, course, not a year.
Not a year.
I'd say like nearly half of that would be infrastructure, which is a one-off.
Mm-hmm.
And also the better the job you did, the more seed you'd be able to sell for a better price too, probably. I don't think it's ongoing. The staffing thing would be ongoing.
Yeah.
So ongoing, maybe $300,000 a year.
Yeah, which is, of course, New Zealand dollars, and that's roughly $200,000 US per year right now.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine that there would be people out there somewhere that care enough that isn't like, it's not an enormous amount of money.
Yeah.
Not really. And like the most appropriate tools and the most appropriate infrastructure, like Jody style, you know, like what you're developing here, that's going to cost a bit. There's also, I think there's some areas that need to be developed and shared with other people so they can do it. And that is, we've got to get everything off grid.
Mm.
I mean, where we are is the end of the line, really, and it's not, power isn't reliable, but people need to be off grid with this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need, we've done plans and budgets for seed storage, and that's, you know, maybe $100,000 there. But the most critical thing is the seed drying and processing. And we're still figuring out, like, we want to be able to do that without being dependent on all these electrical dryers, and we want to do it passive solar and using other appropriate technology. So that's going to be a lot of fun building that. I mean, we've had 2,000-year floods in the last two summers, and which have hugely compromised our ability to save seeds and dry the seeds that we could save. And that's a sort of we need to create some models for how people can do that in their own bioregions. I mean, at the moment, in Hawke's Bay, after the huge floods that we've had in the last 2 years, we've now got a group of people, it's actually the Hawke's Bay Environment Centre, putting funding into sending people to do our two-week seed saving masterclass so that that can go out around the Hawke's Bay and we can have more local food production. But part of that, it's all very well to send people to us, but there's a lot of, really we need a lot of support to actually develop the models and the systems that can be used everywhere by people in a shed and a greenhouse with the gear in it to like effectively process seed and take care of seed so that we don't lose seed and we keep it in good condition is something that no one's really done in using appropriate technology, like which is what we need. So, I mean, that's not hugely expensive to do that. I don't know. I think we've got a budget somewhere for that, but it's not a huge amount of money. None of these things are huge amounts of money. It's just that when you've been doing a job that is a charitable job and you've been doing it without the money for so long, you kind of bankrupt everything, and we've got to get out of that. We've got to, I mean, we always knew that we'd get to a point where the work we were doing was valued a lot more highly by a lot more people. We knew that the day would come. I mean, we're imagining that still that the day will come when the cost of producing industrial seed is going to go through the roof because of the petrochemicals and all the sprays and tractors and petrol. And it'll become a lot more than what it actually costs us. And we've almost reached that point. If you're looking at an industrial packet of seeds now, apart from a few odd exceptions, the numbers and seeds in the packets are getting less and less, and the price isn't going down. And so their value in their packets, if you don't count the heritage value and the organic value and all that, is becoming very similar. So that's taken 20 or 30 years to happen. But I think we'll switch over soon, and ours will become better value because our prices, the way that we do things and we can do them into the future without all the chemicals and sprays and health problems with the plants and all of that means our costs will go down, will not go through the roof. So I kind of see that they are becoming more valuable and more recognised and more understood as our understanding of what creates human health is improving and changing and becoming deeper. And our understanding of the fact we've got to reconnect everything again. Like that whole reconnection thing is huge. And this is just one of the links in the chain. And people are starting to see it, you know, with people like Zach Bush out there talking about this constantly and many other people. So we're trusting that right now that there will be people out there who do understand and want to support. And something that can make a really big difference to a lot of people, and it can be a model. I think that's probably our most important function into the future is a model for bioregional seed production. I mean, I'd be quite happy if we go from being a national seed bank to a bioregional one. There needs to be bioregional seed banks all around this country, all around the world, and we need models for it. I mean, when I do seed saving masterclasses, which I hadn't for a couple of years, but this year it's already full. And last time we did one, I had people from several countries in Europe come and learn how to set up their seed banks based on our model. So Eastern European countries, interestingly enough, I think there's a lot happening over there at the moment. So I feel like just having models on the ground is like one of the most useful things for a lot. I mean, that is a way that we can connect with overseas because America and New Zealand seem to be ahead of a lot of other countries in terms of setting up regenerative systems for agriculture, regenerative agriculture, local food production, even the seeds, America's, So that's a way that we can support other people around the world is just having models for integrated land use, animal systems, integrated food production systems, simple local systems.
And in your bioregion, you mentioned the floods. Can you share more about what's going on and what you've been learning from that? I mean, you and Bob have been really preparing for this your whole lives. And so, you know, they arrived. Tell us about, what that experience has been and where we're at today.
Yeah, it was I had actually never been in a natural disaster like that before. And it was a big learning curve. But we were set up for it. Like, there was two things. The first two things that we realised we were badly missing, because we've been in the process for a while of switching over to cooking on rocket stoves, which means all you need is twigs of wood, you know, bits of wood. And but we hadn't fully got there. And some things, we were largely still cooking on gas. And so when you lose your road and your internet and all means of going anywhere, you run out of gas. So we began our cooking. The first thing we did was we all started eating together and cooking on charcoal barbecues and things like that. So, I mean, you can make charcoal and you can light, make a fire, but a rocket stove would have been better. So that was one thing, and petrol. So anything that runs on petrol, you've got no petrol anymore, you run out. I mean, they had helicopters flying around delivering petrol and gas bottles and things, but it took them a few weeks to get that happening. So the other thing is food, but we had lots of food. So what happened was we lost our cell phones because someone took all the generators from the cell phone towers out. How that happened, I can't begin to imagine. And they kept taking them out when they were replaced. That was very strange.
Wow.
We lost our cell phones. We lost our telephone because the wires went over the river and they just went. We lost our road and we lost our power. We lost everything.
This was in Cyclone Gabrielle.
Well, the first one. And then the second one kind of did the same thing.
Got it.
So, and it wasn't, it wasn't just the rainfall, it was the fact that there's forestry all around us and we've got forestry slash around up where they harvest the trees, they leave a mess and they don't deal with it properly. And so when you have a flood like that, it washes all that into the rivers and that all banked up behind the bridges. And the bridges were like, I mean, we lost some bridges and a lot of bridges were miles underwater, but it banked the water up. And so, and because the soil on the East Coast is, it's like very porous. It's like taupo ash, pumicey kind of soil. And it sucks up all the water very quickly. And then when the water goes, it usually goes down fast. And then all this weight is up there in the soil and it just collapses all the soil. So the river is just like a river of mud. It's just horrible to look at. And all the banks are caving in and the land slipping and the soil need, the hills need trees on them. And the trees have been taken off for sheep farming. And when you sheep farm, the grass is that long and the roots are that long and it can't hold the soil together. So we've reached an ecological catastrophe on the East Coast where the soil is now collapsing everywhere. I mean, it's happened before, Cyclone Bola, and in more minor way. But the whole of the East Coast now is like in a state of people, not many people are growing food. It's just like a huge extraction machine. They're taking out fruit, they're taking out trees, they're taking out the fish, they're taking out wool, and nothing is going back in to hold it together, to build the soil, to build resilience. And so we ended up in a situation where one of time I was going out on a daily basis, I didn't even want to see how he was getting across the river, pulling himself up on a rope to get up the bank on the other side, to meet with all our neighbours every day. And we were essentially feeding a lot of our neighbours
right,
who had no gardens or no way of feeding themselves anything, but it built a lot of community connections. It did start to build strong connections. But the thing that happened, which I'd never experienced and was kind of a shock to feel, was that the less resilient you are as an individual and the less resilient your ecosystem and support network is, the greater the psychological, mental, emotional damage happens. And it happened on a whole community. The whole community is like connected and damaged by this event. And it's going to take generations to repair the roads and the bridges and the hills if people just in the river if people ever get to doing it, but it's also going to take generations to deal with the trauma that's now in all these people. And when it rains now, people are completely traumatized every time it rains. Kids aren't going to school. There's lots of things that are happening which are affecting the whole community. And so the only positive thing that we can do is reconnect like our communities, our valleys, reconnect with our land, our food systems. Like, it just feels like what we've been learning and what we've been doing for the last 40, 50 years is totally on track and we need to be able to keep doing it. But it's quite difficult to do it when you haven't, you're not resourced to do it. So, and I don't see funding or mainstream funding organisations yet making it important enough.
I kind of expected us, if we had that degree of storm and crisis, to kind of get a bit more of a wake-up call as a country. I mean, this was not just like another storm. Like, this was just...
It's a thousand-year flood where we were. Like, our bridge was like 6 meters underwater. The diggers were like, it's just unbelievable where it's gone.
Yeah. In one of the most important food growing regions of the country, affected so many people. And like you said, this is going to take generations to clean up and to recover and heal from. And yet, yeah, like I feel like
it's kind of forgotten.
Kind of forgot it. From a climate policy perspective, if anything, we're going backwards. The conversation doesn't seem like, oh, okay, how do we prepare for this in the future? I don't see, you know, a real integration of understanding happening in conversations that we're a part of. And so, you know, certainly everyone learns different lessons and there's nuance and context, but yeah, I guess I'm just a little bit surprised by that, because I kind of have been of the frame of mind that humanity will, you know, probably wait until it's, you know, too late to do something, and then a crisis will hit and then it will adapt and change. But it almost feels
like the crisis has to be so, like, if it's that, but if it's got to be bigger than what we just had, we're not going to be able to adapt and change.
Right. Right. Because these things just take so long, you know, like the natural cycles of our world don't happen at the kind of, you know, social media cycles that we're now trained and attuned to.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been a real, I mean, I can't see anything else we can do other than do what we're doing. And it's certainly been really, I mean, even just in the flood, we saw how we were resilient in terms of feeding ourselves and supporting other people. But I did see how it affected staff who had come from Aucklanders, and they couldn't ring their families and they couldn't connect with anyone. And now we've got forestry being harvested all around us. Oh my goodness. Being done in a horrible way.
Mm-hmm.
It just goes on and on. Just doesn't, it's hard to see. It's hard to hold the faith sometimes that, that it's going to turn out in a positive way.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I am hoping that someone that isn't as familiar with your work is watching this and is moved to be more interested and compelled to look more into Kawanga. And I also want to protect your time and your energy and, you know, not suggest that people just reach out and, you know, willy-nilly start contacting you or anything like that. But what is the right way to engage with Kawanga? How do people show up to the front door in a way that's, you know, most aligned and respectful and helpful to you? And if they are interested in having maybe specifically a funding conversation, what's the right way to do that?
I would say just contact the office at Kawanga. Contact at Kawanga. And there are people there who will send the calls where they need to go. But if it's to do with funding, I'll talk to people. Yeah.
Yep. contact@kawanga.org.nz.
Yeah.
We'll put links in the show notes. Kay Baxter, I really, again, appreciate the time, and, you know, coming down to our little valley is, it's deeply, deeply appreciated. Any final words or closing reflections that you'd like to share?
I think the biggest joy in my life really is building connection. Just the more we connect, the more joy we feel. And I just like to encourage everyone to just take whatever their first step is to reconnect with the natural environment in whatever way you feel moved to do it. But that's where the joy and the peace comes from.
Mm.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks.
Thanks, man.
Wow. I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Kay. She is truly one of a kind, and we are very lucky to have her here in Aotearoa, New Zealand,
To learn more, go to kawanga.org.nz. As Kay mentioned, you can also reach out at contact@kawanga.org.nz. Listen, you can also message me on LinkedIn or DM me on Twitter, or join the Ma Earth Community Discord to continue this discussion around fundraising for Kawanga Institute. Links are in the show notes. You can find all of our conversations at maearth.com. We appreciate you being on the journey with us. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you next time.